pleasure to inform you that the Tri-Wizard Tournament will be taking place at Hogwarts this year."
"You're joking!" said
Fred Weasley loudly. The tension that had filled the hall ever since Moody's arrival suddenly broke. Nearly everyone laughed, and Dumbledore chuckled appreciatively.
"I am not joking, Mr. Weasley," he said, "though now that you mention it, I did hear an excellent one over the summer about a troll, a hag, and a leprechaun, who all go into a bar."
Professor McGonagall cleared her throat loudly.
But maybe this is not the time."
"No," said Dumbledore. "Where was I?
Ah, yes. The Tri-Wizard Tournament. Well, some of you will not know what this tournament involves, so I hope those who do know will forgive me for giving a short explanation and allow their attention to wander freely. The Tri-Wizard Tournament was first established some 700 years ago as a friendly competition between the three largest European schools of wizardry, Hogwarts, Beauxbatons, and Durmstrang. A champion was selected to represent each school, and the three champions competed in three magical tasks. The schools took it in turns to host the tournament once every 5 years, and it was generally agreed to be a most excellent way of establishing ties between young witches and wizards of different nationalities, until, that is, the death toll mounted so high that the tournament was discontinued.
"Death toll?"
Hermione whispered, looking alarmed, but her anxiety did not seem to be shared by the majority of students in the hall. Many of them were whispering excitedly to one another, and Harry himself was far more interested in hearing about the tournament than in worrying about deaths that had happened hundreds of years ago.
"There have been several attempts over the centuries to reinstate the tournament," Dumbledore continued, "none of which has been very successful. However, our own departments of international magical cooperation and magical games and sports have decided the time is ripe for another attempt. We have worked hard over the summer to ensure that this time no champion will find himself or herself in mortal danger. The heads of Beauxbatons and Durmstrang will be arriving with their shortlisted contenders in October, and the selection of the three champions will take place at Halloween. An impartial judge will decide which students are most worthy to compete for the Tri-Wizard Cup, the glory of their school, and 1,000 galleons personal prize money."
"I'm going for it!"
Fred Weasley hissed down the table, his face lit with enthusiasm at the prospect of such glory and riches. He was not the only person who seemed to be visualizing himself as the Hogwarts champion. At every house table, Harry could see people either gazing raptly at Dumbledore or else whispering fervently to their neighbours. But then Dumbledore spoke again, and the hall quieted once more.
"Eager though I know all of you will be to bring the Tri-Wizard Cup to Hogwarts," he said, "the heads of the participating schools, along with the Ministry of Magic, have agreed to impose an age restriction on contenders this year. Only students who are of age, that is to say 17 years or older, will be allowed to put forward their names for consideration. This..."
Dumbledore raised his voice slightly, for several people had made noises of outrage at these words, and the Weasley twins were suddenly looking furious.
"Is a measure we feel is necessary, given that the tournament tasks will still be difficult and dangerous, whatever precautions we take, and it is highly unlikely that students below 6th and 7th year will be able to cope with them. I will personally be ensuring that no underage student hoodwinks our impartial judge into making them Hogwarts champion."
His light blue eyes twinkled as they flickered over Fred's and George's mutinous faces.
"I therefore beg you not to waste your time submitting yourself if you are under 17. The delegations from Beaubaton and Durmstrang will be arriving in October and remaining with us for the greater part of this year. I know that you will all extend every courtesy to our foreign guests while they are with us, and will give your wholehearted support to the Hogwarts champion when he or she is selected. And now it is late, and I know how important it is to you all to be alert and rested as you enter your lessons tomorrow morning. Bedtime! Chop, chop!
Dumbledore sat down again and turned to talk to Mad-Eye Moody. There was a great scraping and banging as all the students got to their feet and swarmed toward the double doors into the entrance hall.
They can't do that! Said George Weasley, who had not joined the crowd moving toward the door, but was standing up and glaring at Dumbledore. "'We're 17 in April. Why can't we have a shot?'
"'They're not stopping me entering,' said Fred stubbornly, also scowling at the top table. "'The champions'll get to do all sorts of stuff you'd never be allowed to do normally. And 1,000 galleons prize money?'
"'Yeah,' said Ron, a faraway look on his face. "'Yeah, 1,000 galleons. Come on!' said Hermione. "'We'll be the only ones left here if you don't move.'
Harry, Ron, Hermione, Fred and George set off for the entrance hall, Fred and George debating the ways in which Dumbledore might stop those who were under 17 from entering the tournament. "'Who's this impartial judge who's going to decide who the champions are?' said Harry.
"'Dunno,' said Fred. "'But it's them we'll have to fool. I reckon a couple of drops of aging potion might do it, George.'
"'Dumbledore knows you're not of age, though,' said Ron.
"'Yeah, but he's not the one who decides who the champion is, is he?'
said Fred shrewdly.
"'Sounds to me like once this judge knows who wants to enter, he'll choose the best from each school, and never mind how old they are. Dumbledore's trying to stop us giving our names.'
"'People have died, though,' said Hermione in a worried voice as they walked through a door concealed behind a tapestry and started up another narrower staircase.'
"'Yeah,' said Fred airily, "'but that was years ago, wasn't it?
"'Anyway, where's the fun without a bit of risk? "'Hey, Ron, what if we find out how to get round Dumbledore? "'Fancy entering?'
"'What do you reckon?' Ron asked Harry. "'Be cool to enter, wouldn't it? "'But I suppose they might want someone older. "'Dunno if we've learnt enough.'
"'I definitely haven't.' came Neville's gloomy voice from behind Fred and George. "'I expect my gran'd want me to try, though. She's always going on about how I should be upholding the family honour. I'll just have to... Whoops!'
Neville's foot had sunk right through a step halfway up the staircase. There were many of these trick stairs at Hogwarts. It was second nature to most of the older students to jump this particular step, but Neville's memory was notoriously poor. Harry and Ron seized him under the armpits and pulled him out, while a suit of armour at the top of the stairs creaked and clanked, laughing wheezily.
"'Shut it, you!' said Ron, banging down its visor as they passed.
They made their way up to the entrance to Gryffindor Tower, which was concealed behind a large portrait of a fat lady in a pink silk dress.
"'Password!'
she said as they approached.
"'Balderdash!' said George. "'A prefect downstairs told me.'
The portrait swung forward to reveal a hole in the wall through which they all climbed. A crackling fire warmed the circular common room, which was full of squashy armchairs and tables. Hermione cast the merrily dancing flames a dark look, and Harry distinctly heard her mutter, "Slave labour," before bidding them good night and disappearing through the doorway to the girls' dormitory. Harry, Ron and Neville climbed up the last spiral staircase until they reached their own dormitory, which was situated at the top of the tower. 5 four-poster beds with deep crimson hangings stood against the walls, each with its owner's trunk at the foot. Dean and Seamus were already getting into bed. Seamus had pinned his Ireland rosette to his headboard, and Dean had tacked up a poster of Victor Crumb over his bedside table. His old poster of the West Ham football team was pinned right next to it.
"'Mental,'
Ron sighed, shaking his head at the completely stationary soccer players. Harry, Ron and Neville got into their pyjamas and into bed. Someone, a house elf, no doubt, had placed warming pans between the sheets. It was extremely comfortable lying there in bed and listening to the storm raging outside.
"'I might go in for it, you know,' Ron said sleepily through the darkness.
If Fred and George find out how to...
The tournament. You never know, do you?
Suppose not.
Harry rolled over in bed, a series of dazzling new pictures forming in his mind's eye. He had hoodwinked the impartial judge into believing he was 17. He had become Hogwarts champion. He was standing on the grounds, his arms raised in triumph in front of the whole school, all of whom were applauding and screaming. He had just won the Tri-Wizard Tournament. Cho's face stood out particularly clearly in the blurred crowd, her face glowing with admiration. Harry grinned into his pillow, exceptionally glad that Ron couldn't see what he could. Chapter 13 Mad-Eye Moody. The storm had blown itself out by the following morning, though the ceiling in the great hall was still gloomy. Heavy clouds of pewter grey swirled overhead as Harry, Ron, and Hermione examined their new course schedules at breakfast. A few seats along, Fred, George, and Lee Jordan were discussing magical methods of aging themselves and bluffing their way into the Tri-Wizard Tournament.
"Today's not bad. Outside all morning," said Ron, who was running his finger down the Monday column of his schedule. "Herbology with the Hufflepuffs and care of magical creatures. Damn it, we're still with the Slytherins."
"Double divination this afternoon," Harry groaned, looking down. Divination was his least favourite subject, apart from potions. Professor Trelawney kept predicting Harry's death, which he found extremely annoying.
"You should have given it up like me, shouldn't you?" said Hermione briskly, buttering herself some toast. "Then you'd be doing something sensible like arithmancy."
"You're eating again, I notice," said Ron, watching Hermione adding liberal amounts of jam to her toast too.
"I've decided there are better ways of making a stand about elf rights," said Hermione haughtily.
"Yeah, and you were hungry," said Ron, grinning.
There was a sudden rustling noise above them, and 100 owls came soaring through the open windows, carrying the morning mail. Instinctively, Harry looked up, but there was no sign of white among the mass of brown and grey. The owls circled the tables, looking for the people to whom their letters and packages were addressed. A large, tawny owl soared down to Neville Longbottom and deposited a parcel into his lap. Neville almost always forgot to pack something. On the other side of the hall, Draco Malfoy's eagle owl had landed on his shoulder, carrying what looked like his usual supply of sweets and cakes from home. Trying to ignore the sinking feeling of disappointment in his stomach, Harry returned to his porridge. Was it possible that something had happened to Hedwig and that Sirius hadn't even got his letter? His preoccupation lasted all the way across the sodden vegetable patch until they arrived in Greenhouse 3, but here he was distracted by Professor Sprout showing the class the ugliest plants Harry had ever seen. Indeed, they looked less like plants than thick, black, giant slugs protruding vertically out of the soil. Each was squirming slightly and had a number of large, shiny swellings upon it, which appeared to be full of liquid.
"Bubotubers," Professor Sprout told them briskly. "They need squeezing. You will collect the pus."
"The what?" said Seamus Finnegan, sounding revolted.
"Pus, Finnegan, pus," said Professor Sprout. "And it's extremely valuable, so don't waste it. You will collect the pus, I say, in these bottles. Wear your dragonhide gloves. It can do funny things to the skin when undiluted. Bubotuba pus."
Squeezing the bubotubers was disgusting, but oddly satisfying. As each swelling was popped, a large amount of thick yellowish-green liquid burst forth, which smelled strongly of petrol. They caught it in the bottles, as Professor Sprout had indicated, and by the end of the lesson had collected several pints.
"This'll keep Madame Pomfrey happy," said Professor Sprout, stoppering the last bottle with a cork. "An excellent remedy for the more stubborn forms of acne. Bubotuba pus should stop students resorting to desperate measures to rid themselves of pimples."
"Like poor Eloise Midgen,"
said Hannah Abbott, a Hufflepuff, in a hushed voice.
She tried to curse hers off.
Silly girl, said Professor Sprout, shaking her head. But Madame Pomfrey fixed her nose back on in the end.
A booming bell echoed from the castle across the wet grounds, signalling the end of the lesson, and the class separated, the Hufflepuffs climbing the stone steps for transfiguration, and the Gryffindors heading in the other direction, down the sloping lawn toward Hagrid's small wooden cabin, which stood on the edge of the Forbidden Forest. Hagrid was standing outside his hut, one hand on the collar of his enormous black boarhound, Fang. There were several open wooden crates on the ground at his feet, and Fang was whimpering and straining at his collar, apparently keen to investigate the contents more closely. As they drew nearer, an odd rattling noise reached their ears, punctuated by what sounded like minor explosions.
"Morning!" Hagrid said, grinning at Harry, Ron, and Hermione. "Better wait for the Slytherins. They won't want to miss this. Blast-ended scroots!"
"Come again,"
said Ron. Hagrid pointed down into the crates.
"Ugh!"
squealed Lavender Brown, jumping backward.
"Ugh!"
just about summed up the blast-ended scroots, in Harry's opinion. They looked like deformed, shell-less lobsters, horribly pale and slimy-looking, with legs sticking out in very odd places and no visible heads. There were about 100 of them in each crate, each about 6 inches long, crawling over one another, bumping blindly into the sides of the boxes. They were giving off a very powerful smell of rotting fish. Every now and then sparks would fly out of the end of a scroot, and with a small thud, it would be propelled forward several inches.
"Only just hatched," said Hagrid proudly, "so you'll be able to raise 'em yourselves. Thought we'd make a bit of a project of it."
"And why would we want to raise them?" said a cold voice.
The Slytherins had arrived. The speaker was Draco Malfoy. Crabbe and Goyle were chuckling appreciatively at his words. Hagrid looked stumped at the question.
"I mean, what do they do?" asked Malfoy. "What is the point of them?"
Hagrid opened his mouth, apparently thinking hard. There was a few seconds' pause. Then he said roughly,
"That's next lesson, Malfoy. You're just feeding them today. Now, you'll want to try them on a few different things. I've never had 'em before, not sure what they'll go for. I got ant eggs and frog livers and a bit of grass snake. Just try 'em out with a bit of each."
"First pus, and now this," muttered Seamus.
Nothing but deep affection for Hagrid could have made Harry, Ron, and Hermione pick up squelchy handfuls of frog liver and lower them into the crates to tempt the blast-ended scroots. Harry couldn't suppress the suspicion that the whole thing was entirely pointless, because the scroots didn't seem to have mouths.
"Ouch!"
yelled Dean Thomas after about 10 minutes.
"It got me!"
Hagrid hurried over to him, looking anxious.
"Its end exploded!"
said Dean angrily, showing Hagrid a burn on his hand.
"Ah, yeah, that can happen when they blast off,"
said Hagrid, nodding.
"Ugh!"
said Lavender Brown again.
"Oh, Hagrid, what's that pointy thing on it?"
"Ah, some of 'em have got stings,"
said Hagrid enthusiastically. Lavender quickly withdrew her hand from the box.
"I reckon they're the males. The females have got sort of sucker things on their bellies. I think they might be to suck blood."
"Well, I can certainly see why we're trying to keep them alive," said Malfoy sarcastically. "Who wouldn't want pets that can burn, sting, and bite all at once?"
"Just because they're not very pretty, it doesn't mean they're not useful," Hermione snapped. "Dragon blood's amazingly magical, but you wouldn't want a dragon for a pet, would you?"
Harry and Ron grinned at Hagrid, who gave them a furtive smile from behind his bushy beard. Hagrid would have liked nothing better than a pet dragon, as Harry, Ron, and Hermione knew only too well. He had owned one for a brief period during their first year, a vicious Norwegian ridgeback by the name of Norbert. Hagrid simply loved monstrous creatures. The more lethal, the better.
"Well, at least the scroots are small," said Ron as they made their way back up to the castle for lunch an hour later. "They are now,"
said Hermione in an exasperated voice. "But once Hagrid's found out what they eat, I expect they'll be 6 feet long."
"Well, that won't matter if they turn out to cure seasickness or something, will it?"
said Ron, grinning slyly at her.
"You know perfectly well I only said that to shut Malfoy up," said Hermione. "As a matter of fact, I think he's right. The best thing to do would be to stamp on the lot of them before they start attacking us all."
They sat down at the Gryffindor table and helped themselves to lamb chops and potatoes. Hermione began to eat so fast that Harry and Ron stared at her.
"Is this the new stand on Elf Rights?" said Ron. "You're going to make yourself puke instead?"
"No,"
said Hermione, with as much dignity as she could muster with her mouth bulging with sprouts.
"I just want to get to the library."
"What?"
said Ron in disbelief.
"Hermione, it's the first day back. We haven't even got homework yet."
Hermione shrugged and continued to shovel down her food as though she had not eaten for days. Then she leapt to her feet, said, "See you at dinner," and departed at high speed. When the bell rang to signal the start of afternoon lessons, Harry and Ron set off for North Tower, where, at the top of a tightly spiralling staircase, a silver stepladder led to a circular trapdoor in the ceiling and the room where Professor Trelawney lived. The familiar sweet perfume spreading from the fire met their nostrils as they emerged at the top of the stepladder. As ever, the curtains were all closed. The circular room was bathed in a dim reddish light cast by the many lamps, which were all draped with scarves and shawls. Harry and Ron walked through the mass of occupied chintz chairs and puffs that cluttered the room, and sat down at the same small circular table.
"Good day,"
said the misty voice of Professor Trelawney right behind Harry, making him jump. A very thin woman with enormous glasses that made her eyes appear far too large for her face, Professor Trelawney was peering down at Harry with the tragic expression she always wore whenever she saw him. The usual large amount of beads, chains, and bangles glittered upon her person in the firelight.
"You are preoccupied, my dear,"
she said mournfully to Harry.
"My inner eye sees past your brave face to the troubled soul within, and I regret to say that your worries are not baseless. I see difficult times ahead for you, alas, most difficult. I fear the thing you dread will indeed come to pass, and perhaps sooner than you think."
Her voice dropped almost to a whisper. Ron rolled his eyes at Harry, who looked stonily back. Professor Trelawney swept past them and seated herself in a large winged armchair before the fire, facing the class. Lavender Brown and Parvati Patil, who deeply admired Professor Trelawney, were sitting on puffs very close to her.
"My dears, it is time for us to consider the stars," she said. "The movements of the planets and the mysterious portents they reveal only to those who understand the steps of the celestial dance. Human destiny may be deciphered by the planetary rays, which intermingle."
But Harry's thoughts had drifted. The perfume fire always made him feel sleepy and dull-witted, and Professor Trelawney's rambling talks on fortune-telling never held him exactly spellbound, though he couldn't help thinking about what she had just said to him.
"I fear the thing you dread will indeed come to pass."
But Hermione was right, Harry thought irritably. Professor Trelawney really was an old fraud. He wasn't dreading anything at the moment at all. Well, unless you counted his fears that Sirius had been caught. But what did Professor Trelawney know? He had long since come to the conclusion that her brand of fortune-telling was really no more than lucky guesswork and a spooky manner. Except, of course, for that time, at the end of last term, when she had made the prediction about Voldemort rising again, and Dumbledore himself had said that he thought that trance had been genuine when Harry had described it to him.
"Harry!"
Ron muttered.
"What?"
Harry looked around. The whole class was staring at him. He sat up straight. He had been almost dozing off, lost in the heat and his thoughts.
"I was saying, my dear, that you were clearly born under the baleful influence of Saturn,"
said Professor Trelawney, a faint note of resentment in her voice at the fact that he had obviously not been hanging on her words.
"Born under... what? Sorry,"
said Harry.
"Saturn, dear, the planet Saturn,"
said Professor Trelawney, sounding definitely irritated that he wasn't riveted by this news.
I was saying that Saturn was surely in a position of power in the heavens at the moment of your birth. Your dark hair, your mean stature, tragic losses so young in life. I think I am right in saying, my dear, that you were born in midwinter.
No, said Harry, I was born in July. Ron hastily turned his laugh into a hacking cough. Half an hour later, each of them had been given a complicated circular chart and was attempting to fill in the position of the planets at their moment of birth. It was dull work, requiring much consultation of timetables and calculation of angles.
"I've got two Neptunes here," said Harry after a while, frowning down at his piece of parchment. "That can't be right, can it?"
"Ah," said Ron, imitating Professor Trelawney's mystical whisper.
"When two Neptunes appear in the sky, it is a sure sign that a midget in glasses is being born, Harry."
Seamus and Dean, who were working nearby, sniggered loudly, though not loudly enough to mask the excited squeals from Lavender Brown.
"Oh, Professor, look! I think I've got an unaspected planet. Ooh, which one's that, Professor?"
"It is Uranus, my dear," said Professor Trelawney, peering down at the chart.
"Can I have a look at Uranus, too, Lavender?" said Ron.
Most unfortunately, Professor Trelawney heard him, and it was this, perhaps, that made her give them so much homework at the end of the class.
"A detailed analysis of the way the planetary movements in the coming month will affect you with reference to your personal chart," she snapped, sounding much more like Professor McGonagall than her usual airy-fairy self. "I want it ready to hand in next Monday, and no excuses."
"Miserable old bat," said Ron bitterly as they joined the crowds descending the staircases back to the great hall and dinner.
"That'll take all weekend, that will."
"Lots of homework,"
said Hermione brightly, catching up with them.
"Professor Vector didn't give us any at all."
"Well, bully for Professor Vector," said Ron moodily.
They reached the entrance hall, which was packed with people queuing for dinner. They had just joined the end of the line when a loud voice ran out behind them.
"Weasley! Hey, Weasley!"
Harry, Ron and Hermione turned. Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle were standing there, each looking thoroughly pleased about something.
"What?" said Ron shortly.
"Your dad's in the paper, Weasley," said Malfoy, brandishing a copy of the Daily Prophet and speaking very loudly so that everyone in the packed entrance hall could hear. "Listen to this! Further mistakes at the Ministry of Magic. It seems as though the Ministry of Magic's troubles are not yet at an end," writes Rita Skeeter, special correspondent. "Recently under fire for its poor crowd control at the Quidditch World Cup, and still unable to account for the disappearance of one of its witches, the Ministry was plunged into fresh embarrassment yesterday by the antics of Arnold Weasley of the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts Office."
Malfoy looked up.
"Imagine them not even getting his name right, Weasley. It's almost as though he's a complete non-entity, isn't it?"
he crowed. Everyone in the entrance hall was listening now. Malfoy straightened the paper with a flourish and read on.
"Arnold Weasley, who was charged with possession of a flying car 2 years ago, was yesterday involved in a tussle with several Muggle lawkeepers, policemen, over a number of highly aggressive dustbins. Mr. Weasley appeared to have rushed to the aid of Mad-Eye Moody, the aged ex-auror, who retired from the Ministry when no longer able to tell the difference between a handshake and attempted murder. Unsurprisingly, Mr. Weasley found, upon arrival at Mr. Moody's heavily guarded house, that Mr. Moody had once again raised a false alarm. Mr. Weasley was forced to modify several memories before he could escape from the policeman, but refused to answer Daily Prophet questions about why he had involved the Ministry in such an undignified and potentially embarrassing scene."
And there's a picture, Weasley, said Malfoy, flipping the paper over and holding it up. A picture of your parents outside their house, if you can call it a house. Your mother could do with losing a bit of weight, couldn't she?
Ron was shaking with fury. Everyone was staring at him.
Get stuffed, Malfoy, said Harry. Come on, Ron.
Oh, yeah. You were staying with them this summer, weren't you, Potter?
Sneered Malfoy.
So tell me, is his mother really that porky, or is it just the picture?
You know your mother, Malfoy, said Harry. Both he and Hermione had grabbed the back of Ron's robes to stop him from launching himself at Malfoy. That expression she's got, like she's got dung under her nose. Has she always looked like that, or was it just because you were with her?
Malfoy's pale face went slightly pink.
Don't you dare insult my mother, Potter.
Keep your fat mouth shut, then, said Harry, turning away.
Bang!
Several people screamed. Harry felt something white-hot graze the side of his face. He plunged his hand into his robes for his wand, but before he'd even touched it, he heard a second loud bang and a roar that echoed through the entrance hall.
Oh, no, you don't, laddie!
Harry spun around. Professor Moody was limping down the marble staircase. His wand was out, and it was pointing right at a pure white ferret, which was shivering on the stone-flagged floor, exactly where Malfoy had been standing. There was a terrified silence in the entrance hall. Nobody but Moody was moving a muscle. Moody turned to look at Harry. At least, his normal eye was looking at Harry. The other one was pointing into the back of his head.
"Did he get you?"
Moody growled. His voice was low and gravelly.
"No," said Harry. "Missed."
"Leave it!"
Moody shouted.
"Leave what?" Harry said, bewildered.
"Not you. Him,"
Moody growled, jerking his thumb over his shoulder at Crabbe, who had just frozen, about to pick up the white ferret. It seemed that Moody's rolling eye was magical and could see out of the back of his head. Moody started to limp toward Crabbe, Goyle, and the ferret, which gave a terrified squeak and took off, streaking toward the dungeons.
"I don't think so!"
roared Moody, pointing his wand at the ferret again. It flew 10 feet into the air, fell with a smack to the floor, and then bounced upward once more.
"I don't like people who attack when their opponents' backs turned," growled Moody, as the ferret bounced higher and higher, squealing in pain. "Stinking, cowardly, scummy thing to do!"
The ferret flew through the air, its legs and tail flailing helplessly.
"Never do that again,"
said Moody, speaking each word as the ferret hit the stone floor and bounced upward again.
"Professor Moody!" said a shocked voice.
Professor McGonagall was coming down the marble staircase with her arms full of books.
"Hello, Professor McGonagall," said Moody calmly, bouncing the ferret still higher.
What are you doing?"
said Professor McGonagall, her eyes following the bouncing ferret's progress through the air.
"Teaching," said Moody.
"Teach? Moody, is that a student?"
shrieked Professor McGonagall, the books spilling out of her arms.
"Yep,"
said Moody.
"No!"
cried Professor McGonagall, running down the stairs and pulling out her wand. A moment later, with a loud snapping noise, Draco Malfoy had reappeared, lying in a heap on the floor, with his sleek blonde hair all over his now brilliantly pink face. He got to his feet, wincing.
"Moody! We never use transfiguration as a punishment,"
said Professor McGonagall weakly.
"Surely Professor Dumbledore told you that?"
"He might have mentioned it, yeah,"
said Moody, scratching his chin unconcernedly.
"But I thought a good sharp shock."
"We give detentions, Moody, or speak to the offender's head of house."
"I'll do that then,"
said Moody, staring at Malfoy with great dislike. Malfoy, whose pale eyes were still watering with pain and humiliation, looked malevolently up at Moody and muttered something in which the words "my father" were distinguishable.
"Oh, yeah,"
said Moody, quietly, limping forward a few steps, the dull clunk of his wooden leg echoing around the hall.
"Well, I know your father of old, boy. You tell him Moody's keeping a close eye on his son. You tell him that from me. Now, your head of house'll be Snape, will it?"
"Yes," said Malfoy resentfully.
"Another old friend," growled Moody. "I've been looking forward to a chat with old Snape. Come on, you."
And he seized Malfoy's upper arm and marched him off toward the dungeons. Professor McGonagall stared anxiously after them for a few moments, then waved her wand at her fallen books, causing them to soar up into the air and back into her arms.
"Don't talk to me,"
Ron said quietly to Harry and Hermione as they sat down at the Gryffindor table a few minutes later, surrounded by excited talk on all sides about what had just happened.
"Why not?"
said Hermione in surprise.
"Because I want to fix that in my memory forever," said Ron, his eyes closed and an uplifted expression on his face. "Draco Malfoy, the amazing bouncing ferret."
Harry and Hermione both laughed, and Hermione began doling beef casserole onto each of their plates.
"He could have really hurt Malfoy, though," she said. "It was good, really, that Professor McGonagall stopped it."
"Hermione," said Ron furiously, his eyes snapping open again, "you're ruining the best moment of my life." Hermione made an impatient noise and began to eat at top speed again.
"Don't tell me you're going back to the library this evening," said Harry, watching her. "Got to," said Hermione thickly. "Loads to do."
"But you told us, Professor Vector..."
"It's not schoolwork," she said.
Within 5 minutes she had cleared her plate and departed. No sooner had she gone than her seat was taken by Fred Weasley.
"Moody," he said, "how cool is he?"
"Beyond cool," said George, sitting down opposite Fred.
"Super cool,"
said the twins' best friend, Lee Jordan, sliding into the seat beside George.
"We had him this afternoon," he told Harry and Ron.
"What was it like?" said Harry eagerly.
Fred, George, and Lee exchanged looks full of meaning.
"Never had a lesson like it," said Fred.
"He knows, man," said Lee.
"Knows what?" said Ron, leaning forward.
"Knows what it's like to be out there doing it," said George impressively.
"Doing what?" said Harry.
"Fighting the dark arts," said Fred.
"He's seen it all," said George.
"Amazing," said Lee.
Ron dived into his bag for his schedule.
"We haven't got him till Thursday," he said in a disappointed voice.
Chapter 14 The Unforgivable Curses. The next 2 days passed without great incident, unless you counted Neville melting his sixth cauldron in potions. Professor Snape, who seemed to have attained new levels of vindictiveness over the summer, gave Neville detention, and Neville returned from it in a state of nervous collapse, having been made to disembowel a barrel full of horned toads.
"You know why Snape's in such a foul mood, don't you?"
said Ron to Harry, as they watched Hermione teaching Neville a scouring charm to remove the frog guts from under his fingernails.
"Yeah," said Harry. "Moody."
It was common knowledge that Snape really wanted the dark arts job, and he had now failed to get it for the 4th year running. Snape had disliked all of their previous dark arts teachers and shown it, but he seemed strangely wary of displaying overt animosity to Mad-Eye Moody. Indeed, whenever Harry saw the two of them together, at mealtimes or when they passed in the corridors, he had the distinct impression that Snape was avoiding Moody's eye, whether magical or normal.
"I reckon Snape's a bit scared of him, you know," Harry said thoughtfully.
"Imagine if Moody turned Snape into a horned toad," said Ron, his eyes misting over, "and bounced him all around his dungeon."
The Gryffindor 4th years were looking forward to Moody's first lesson so much that they arrived early on Thursday lunchtime and queued up outside his classroom before the bell had even rung. The only person missing was Hermione, who turned up just in time for the lesson.
"Been in the..."
"Library," Harry finished her sentence for her. "Come on, quick, or we won't get decent seats."
They hurried into three chairs right in front of the teacher's desk, took out their copies of The Dark Forces, A Guide to Self-Protection, and waited, unusually quiet. Soon they heard Moody's distinctive clunking footsteps coming down the corridor, and he entered the room, looking as strange and frightening as ever. They could just see his clawed wooden foot protruding from underneath his robes.
"You can put those away,"
he growled, stumping over to his desk and sitting down.
"Those books, you won't need them."
They returned the books to their bags, Ron looking excited. Moody took out a register, shook his long mane of grizzled grey hair out of his twisted and scarred face, and began to call out names, his normal eye moving steadily down the list, while his magical eyes swiveled around, fixing upon each student as he or she answered.
"Right, then," he said, when the last person had declared themselves present. "I've had a letter from Professor Lupin about this class. Seems you've had a pretty thorough grounding in tackling dark creatures. You've covered boggarts, red caps, hinky punks, grindly lows, kappas, and werewolves. Is that right?"
There was a general murmur of assent.
"But you're behind, very behind, on dealing with curses," said Moody. "So I'm here to bring you up to scratch on what wizards can do to each other. I've got 1 year to teach you how to deal with dark—"
"What? Aren't you staying?"
Ron blurted out. Moody's magical eyes spun around to stare at Ron. Ron looked extremely apprehensive, but after a moment Moody smiled. The first time Harry had seen him do so, the effect was to make his heavily scarred face look more twisted and contorted than ever, but it was nevertheless good to know that he ever did anything as friendly as smile. Ron looked deeply relieved.
"You'll be Arthur Weasley's son, eh?" Moody said. "Your father got me out of a very tight corner a few days ago." "Yeah, I'm staying just the 1 year. Special favor to Dumbledore. 1 year, and then back to my quiet retirement."
He gave a harsh laugh and then clapped his gnarled hands together.
"So, straight into it. Curses. They come in many strengths and forms. Now, according to the Ministry of Magic, I'm supposed to teach you counter curses and leave it at that. I'm not supposed to show you what illegal dark curses look like until you're in the 6th year. You're not supposed to be old enough to deal with it till then. But Professor Dumbledore's got a higher opinion of your nerves. He reckons you can cope. And I say the sooner you know what you're up against, the better. How are you supposed to defend yourself against something you've never seen? A wizard who's about to put an illegal curse on you isn't going to tell you what he's about to do. He's not going to do it nice and polite to your face. You need to be prepared. You need to be alert and watchful. You need to put that away, Miss Brown, when I'm talking."
Lavender jumped and blushed. She had been showing Parvati her completed horoscope under the desk. Apparently Moody's magical eye could see through solid wood, as well as out of the back of his head.
"So, do any of you know which curses are most heavily punished by wizarding law?"
Several hands rose tentatively into the air, including Ron's and Hermione's. Moody pointed at Ron, though his magical eye was still fixed on Lavender.
Said Ron tentatively, "my dad told me about one. Is it called the Imperius Curse or something?" "Ah, yes," said Moody appreciatively. "Your father would know that one. Gave the Ministry a lot of trouble at one time, the Imperius Curse."
Moody got heavily to his mismatched feet, opened his desk drawer, and took out a glass jar. Three large black spiders were scuttling around inside it. Harry felt Ron recoil slightly next to him. Ron hated spiders. Moody reached into the jar, caught one of the spiders, and held it in the palm of his hand so that they could all see it. He then pointed his wand at it and muttered,
"Imperio!"
The spider leapt from Moody's hand on a fine thread of silk and began to swing backward and forward as though on a trapeze. It stretched out its legs rigidly, then did a backflip, breaking the thread and landing on the desk, where it began to cartwheel in circles. Moody jerked his wand, and the spider rose onto two of its hind legs and went into what was unmistakably a tap dance. Everyone was laughing. Everyone except Moody.
"Think it's funny, do you?" he growled. "You'd like it, would you, if I did it to you?"
The laughter died away almost instantly.
"Total control,"
said Moody quietly, as the spider balled itself up and began to roll over and over.
"I could make it jump out of the window, drown itself, throw itself down one of your throats."
Ron gave an involuntary shudder.
"Years back, there were a lot of witches and wizards being controlled by the imperious curse," said Moody,
and Harry knew he was talking about the days in which Voldemort had been all-powerful.
"Some job for the Ministry, trying to sort out who was being forced to act and who was acting of their own free will. The imperious curse can be fought, and I'll be teaching you how, but it takes real strength of character, and not everyone's got it. Better avoid being hit with it if you can." "Constant vigilance!" he barked, and everyone jumped.
Moody picked up the somersaulting spider and threw it back into the jar.
"Anyone else know one? Another illegal curse?"
Hermione's hand flew into the air again, and so, to Harry's slight surprise, did Neville's. The only class in which Neville usually volunteered information was herbology, which was easily his best subject. Neville looked surprised at his own daring.
"Yes,"
said Moody, his magical eye rolling right over to fix on Neville.
"There's one, the Cruciatus Curse,"
said Neville in a small but distinct voice. Moody was looking very intently at Neville, this time with both eyes.
"Your name's Longbottom,"
he said, his magical eyes swooping down to check the register again. Neville nodded nervously, but Moody made no further inquiries. Turning back to the class at large, he reached into the jar for the next spider and placed it upon the desktop, where it remained motionless, apparently too scared to move.
"The Cruciatus Curse," said Moody. "Needs to be a bit bigger for you to get the idea," he said, pointing his wand at the spider. "Engorgio."
The spider swelled. It was now larger than a tarantula. Abandoning all pretense, Ron pushed his chair backward as far away from Moody's desk as possible. Moody raised his wand again, pointed it at the spider, and muttered,
"Crucio!"
At once, the spider's legs bent in upon its body. It rolled over and began to twitch horribly, rocking from side to side. No sound came from it, but Harry was sure that if it could have given voice, it would have been screaming. Moody did not remove his wand, and the spider started to shudder and jerk more violently.
"Stop it!"
Hermione said shrilly. Harry looked around at her. She was looking not at the spider, but at Neville, and Harry, following her gaze, saw that Neville's hands were clenched upon the desk in front of him, his knuckles white, his eyes wide and horrified. Moody raised his wand. The spider's legs relaxed, but it continued to twitch.
"Reducio,"
Moody muttered, and the spider shrank back to its proper size. He put it back into the jar.
"Pain," said Moody softly. "You don't need thumbscrews or knives to torture someone if you can perform the Cruciatus Curse. That one was very popular once, too. Right. Anyone know any others?"
Harry looked around. From the looks on everyone's faces, he guessed they were all wondering what was going to happen to the last spider. Hermione's hand shook slightly, as for the third time she raised it into the air.
"Yes?"
said Moody, looking at her.
"Avada Kedavra,"
Hermione whispered. Several people looked uneasily around at her, including Ron.
"Ah," said Moody, another slight smile twisting his lopsided mouth. "Yes, the last and worst. Avada Kedavra, the killing curse."
He put his hand into the glass jar, and almost as though it knew what was coming, the third spider scuttled frantically around the bottom of the jar, trying to evade Moody's fingers, but he trapped it and placed it upon the desktop. It started to scuttle frantically across the wooden surface. Moody raised his wand, and Harry felt a sudden thrill of foreboding.
"Avada Kedavra!"
Moody roared. There was a flash of blinding green light and a rushing sound, as though a vast, invisible something was soaring through the air. Instantaneously, the spider rolled over onto its back, unmarked but unmistakably dead. Several of the students stifled cries. Ron had thrown himself backward and almost toppled off his seat as the spider skidded toward him. Moody swept the dead spider off the desk onto the floor.
"Not nice," he said calmly. "Not pleasant. And there's no counter-curse. There's no blocking it. Only one known person has ever survived it. And he's sitting right in front of me."
Harry felt his face redden as Moody's eyes, both of them, looked into his own. He could feel everyone else looking around at him, too. Harry stared at the blank blackboard as though fascinated by it, but not really seeing it at all. So that was how his parents had died, exactly like that spider. Had they been unblemished and unmarked, too? Had they simply seen the flash of green light and heard the rush of speeding death before life was wiped from their bodies? Harry had been picturing his parents' deaths over and over again for 3 years now, ever since he'd found out that they had been murdered, ever since he'd found out what had happened that night. Wormtail had betrayed his parents' whereabouts to Voldemort, who had come to find them at their cottage. How Voldemort had killed Harry's father first. How James Potter had tried to hold him off while he shouted at his wife to take Harry and run. Voldemort had advanced on Lily Potter, told her to move aside so that he could kill Harry. How she had begged him to kill her instead, refused to stop shielding her son. And so Voldemort had murdered her, too, before turning his wand on Harry. Harry knew these details because he had heard his parents' voices when he had fought the Dementors last year, for that was the terrible power of the Dementors, to force their victims to relive the worst memories of their lives and drown powerless in their own despair. Moody was speaking again, from a great distance, it seemed to Harry. With a massive effort, he pulled himself back to the present and listened to what Moody was saying.
"Avada Kedavra is a curse that needs a powerful bit of magic behind it. You could all get your wands out now and point them at me and say the words, and I doubt I'd get so much as a nosebleed, but that doesn't matter. I'm not here to teach you how to do it. Now, if there's no counter curse, why am I showing you? Because you've got to know. You've got to appreciate what the worst is. You don't want to find yourself in a situation where you're facing it. Constant vigilance!" he roared, and the whole class jumped again. "Now, those three curses, Avada Kedavra, Imperius, and Cruciatus, are known as the unforgivable curses. The use of any one of them on a fellow human being is enough to earn a life sentence in Azkaban. That's what you're up against. That's what I've got to teach you to fight. You need preparing. You need arming. But most of all, you need to practice constant, never-ceasing vigilance. Get out your quills. Copy this down."
They spent the rest of the lesson taking notes on each of the unforgivable curses. No one spoke until the bell rang. But when Moody had dismissed them, and they had left the classroom, a torrent of talk burst forth. Most people were discussing the curses in awed voices.
"Did you see it twitch? And when he killed it, just like that!"
They were talking about the lesson, Harry thought, as though it had been some sort of spectacular show. But he hadn't found it very entertaining, and nor, it seemed, had Hermione.
"Hurry up!"
she said tensely to Harry and Ron. "Not the ruddy library again," said Ron.
"No,"
said Hermione curtly, pointing up a side passage.
"Neville!"
Neville was standing alone, halfway up the passage, staring at the stone wall opposite him with the same horrified, wide-eyed look he had worn when Moody had demonstrated the Cruciatus curse.
"Neville?"
Hermione said gently. Neville looked around.
"Oh, hello,"
he said, his voice much higher than usual.
"Interesting lesson, wasn't it? I wonder what's for dinner. I'm starving, aren't you?"
"Neville, are you all right?" said Hermione.
"Oh, yes, I'm fine."
Neville gabbled in the same unnaturally high voice.
"Very interesting dinner. I mean, lesson. What's for eating?"
Ron gave Harry a startled look. "Neville, what?" But an odd clunking noise sounded behind them, and they turned to see Professor Moody limping toward them. All four of them fell silent, watching him apprehensively. But when he spoke, it was in a much lower and gentler growl than they had yet heard.
"It's all right, Sonny," he said to Neville. "Why don't you come up to my office? Come on. We can have a cup of tea."
Neville looked even more frightened at the prospect of tea with Moody. He neither moved nor spoke. Moody turned his magical eye upon Harry.
"You all right, are you, Potter?"
"Yes," said Harry, almost defiantly. Moody's blue eye quivered slightly in its socket as it surveyed Harry. Then he said,
"You've got to know. It seems harsh, maybe, but you've got to know. No point pretending. Well, come on, Longbottom. I've got some books that might interest you."
Neville looked pleadingly at Harry, Ron, and Hermione, but they didn't say anything. So Neville had no choice but to allow himself to be steered away, one of Moody's gnarled hands on his shoulder.
"What was that about?"
said Ron, watching Neville and Moody turn the corner.
"I don't know,"
said Hermione, looking pensive.
"Some lesson, though, eh?"
said Ron to Harry as they set off for the great hall.
"Fred and George were right, weren't they? He really knows his stuff. Moody, doesn't he? When he did Avada Kedavra, the way that spider just died. Just snuffed it, right?"
But Ron fell suddenly silent at the look on Harry's face, and didn't speak again until they reached the great hall, when he said he supposed they had better make a start on Professor Trelawney's predictions tonight, since they would take hours. Hermione did not join in with Harry and Ron's conversation during dinner, but ate furiously fast, and then left for the library again. Harry and Ron walked back to Gryffindor Tower, and Harry, who had been thinking of nothing else all through dinner, now raised the subject of the unforgivable curses himself.
"Wouldn't Moody and Dumbledore be in trouble with the Ministry if they knew we'd seen the curses?"
Harry asked as they approached the fat lady.
"Yeah, probably," said Ron. "But Dumbledore's always done things his way, hasn't he? And Moody's been getting in trouble for years, I reckon. Attacks first and asks questions later. Look at his dustbins.
Balderdash!" The fat lady swung forward to reveal the entrance hall, and they climbed into the Gryffindor common room, which was crowded and noisy.
"Shall we get our divination stuff, then?"
said Harry.
"I suppose,"
Ron groaned. They went up to the dormitory to fetch their books and charts, to find Neville there alone, sitting on his bed reading. He looked a good deal calmer than at the end of Moody's lesson, though still not entirely normal. His eyes were rather red.
"You all right, Neville?" Harry asked him. "Oh, yes," said Neville. "I'm fine, thanks. Just reading this book Professor Moody lent me."
He held up the book, Magical Water Plants of the Mediterranean.
"Apparently, Professor Sprout told Professor Moody I'm really good at herbology,"
Neville said. There was a faint note of pride in his voice that Harry had rarely heard there before.
He thought I'd like this.
Telling Neville what Professor Sprout had said, Harry thought, had been a very tactful way of cheering Neville up. For Neville very rarely heard that he was good at anything. It was the sort of thing Professor Lupin would have done. Harry